Hello, everyone. Before we start today's podcast, some exciting news for you. You can experience the Inside Politics podcast live in Dublin on May 16th when Hugh Linehan, Jennifer Bray and I will be joined by Cliff Young of Ipsos, one of America's top pollsters, to talk about the US election, our own local and European elections and much more. It's a breakfast event kicking off at 8 a.m. in Trinity College. If you'd like to attend, you can get tickets at irishtimes.com/events. That's irishtimes.com/events. I hope we see lots of you there.
It's Wednesday, August the 12th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Today I'm joined by Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones from our political team, and also a rare visit from our health editor, Paul Cullen. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Hi, Hugh.
I'll go to you first. I'm going to ask the political team in a minute about this morning's story on the front of the Irish Times about the government's new colour-coded plan for managing COVID-19 across the country. But I want to start with an easy question to you. How are things going and how well is it being handled by the Irish state?
Well, it's a mixed situation. Obviously, we thought we were doing really well for a few months. Very low cases, very proud of ourselves, one of the lowest incidences in Europe. And now we've been hit by a big spike again, and it's happened really quickly. And we're left wondering why it's happened so quickly. It's very specific. That's probably a good thing. Most of the cases are in, as we know, a cluster of meat factories in the Midlands. The people involved who contracted the disease are mostly younger, so they probably won't have a serious disease as we saw earlier in the epidemic. So it's not all bad, but it is alarming how fast the disease took off in these environments. We did have problems with meat plants earlier in the spring, and we thought we'd dealt with it, be there 1,000 cases or more. So we should have had that knowledge to learn to avoid that. Now, from talking to the meat companies, it does seem that at least some of them have done a lot or tried to do a lot to minimize the infection. And they seem perplexed by how fast, like how to go from naught or one case to about 60 in the space of a week. It just shows you what can happen. We do know from other countries, meat factories, particular environment, the temperature is low, people are working at close quarters. Often the air is recirculated, and I think that's going to be a key area of examination in Ireland. People might be shouting as well, which spreads the disease more easily. So perhaps we should have learned more from that. But it does seem now that from the figures last night, and there is a health warning not to take individual days' figures, but the last few days seems to show that most of the cases in those factories have been identified and tested. And hopefully they will come under control. There is an amount of community transmission in a lot of other counties. It's not massive yet, but I'd say inevitably some of those outbreaks will become bigger and we're going to have to face them. And so we might be moving on to a new phase shortly.
I mean, we have seen in other countries, for example, I think a few weeks ago in Germany, a spike around the meat industry can really kind of change the overall national figures for a couple of weeks at least. And can that be more misleading than it should be, really? I mean, is something like this particular outbreak containable, or the community transmission you referred to there, is that more deeply worrying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was conscious of this. You know, a big outbreak will distort a country's figures. And to the extent that NPHET officials this week have been saying, well, if you left out the three Midlands counties, we'd be doing quite well. But the government didn't apply that with other countries, Spain or Germany or whatever, which have had big regional outbreaks. But for example, you know, to take Spain as an example, the Canary Islands have fairly low incidence, and that would be of interest to a lot of Irish people. But that wasn't taken into account when we were drawing up green lists. So, you know, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And, you know, we're going to have to start realizing you deal with the disease where it is rather than taking large geographical boundaries, because they have less meaning, really. And you deal with the level of disease that is circulating in the community. And that's the key one, the ones you don't know, the ones you can't trace to close contacts or specific outbreaks. We are getting a bit of that. As a percentage, it's not increasing, but because the number of cases have increased in recent days, we have more of those cases. And we're going to have to put out those particular fires.
So, Jen, that sort of reality which Paul describes is presumably underlies the thinking of the government in our story on the front of the Irish Times today, which is about moving away from the phases which we've been familiar with, this narrative of gradually easing restrictions over the course of the summer. We appear to be coming to the end of that, even though we didn't quite get to the end of it as laid out originally, and moving now to something which is colour-coded and perhaps more regional or even local.
Yeah, and it does feed back into what Paul was saying. I think with this new second wave and, like Paul said, the speed of it, I think the reality is hitting home with a lot of people that this thing is, it really and truly is here to stay. at least for the foreseeable future. And I think the government have been looking at ways in which maybe they could change their messaging, or ways in which they can communicate with the public in a way that's probably more sustainable long term, and less about on this date X will open, on the next date the next sector will open. Because what the feeling is that what that leads to is just an incredible sense of disappointment from the public when we get to August 10th and all these various things don't come to be open. And I think also the thinking in government is that those arbitrary dates, setting a date, won't work when the virus can pop up at any time, anywhere, in any place. So what they're looking at now is a different plan that would see different colour codes. So you'd be talking about either a status red, orange, yellow or blue. Now, the kind of depressing thing actually is that status blue won't come into effect until there is a vaccination or until there is some other kind of medical breakthrough that will effectively suppress the virus to extremely low levels, whereby the vast majority of normal life can resume. So we're really quite some way away from that. So if they bring in the system, which it looks like they will, we will always be in a state red, yellow or orange for the foreseeable future. And it will be kind of what we're seeing now in the Midlands, tailored to different areas. So you could have an orange over towards the Midlands. Actually, I should clarify as well that green was completely ruled out, because the thinking behind if you have a status green is that everything's okay and life can resume as normal. And that's just not the case. So you could have status orange, red somewhere, and then maybe a status yellow, maybe in Dublin or other areas. So it's basically tailoring the country's response to the virus. So it's more reactive. It's more of a live framework is what they're calling it. And it's something maybe they think that we'd be able to, I suppose, react in the way we react to weather warnings. You know, if there's a status red coming in, you stay indoors, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the thinking behind the framework, or the new framework that they're working on.
I suppose, Jack, you know, messaging is incredibly important. And as this situation becomes more complex, you know, as we moved out of the complete shutdown mode into this more complex kind of a world, the messaging becomes more challenging to make it clear. But it's quite significant, isn't it, to move away from the narrative of we're coming out of this crisis to a narrative of we're now in this ongoing world, which is going to continue for the indefinite future, perhaps for years.
Yeah, and you can kind of see how it makes sense for them to do this, because when you take a step back and look at the phased reopening plan, which had these drop dead dates attached to it, it kind of presumes that there's this kind of linear progression of the virus through society and through business, and that as each phase comes to an end, it will not be problematic. It'll be easy to move into the next one. And as we've seen particularly acutely in the last few days, that's not the case. Things pop up, explosions of the virus happen, and we have to be able to be more nimble in terms of adjusting to it. And incidentally, I understand that the phased reopening approach also prompted a lot of kind of internal pressure within government as different sectors lobbied intensely, looking to say, oh, I'm in phase three, can you move me back to phase two? Or why can't you go into phase four? My business is dying on its feet. We saw this earlier in the spring with the hairdressers, and now obviously the most kind of pressing sector that's looking for changes is the pubs. What I think the government has to be particularly aware of here is the danger for another kind of mixed messaging farrago to erupt, because we're moving now from this kind of relatively abstract notion of phases into this new and still abstract notion of colours. And they need to explain quite clearly when we switch from one to the other and what exactly that means. So all the various bits around the phases, like the €9 substantial meal, does that perpetuate itself when we switch into a phase yellow? Will businesses be expected to define for themselves, or indeed sports clubs or any other part of society be expected to define for themselves what phase yellow or status red means for them? Or will that be done in concert with public health? And we've seen throughout this that different sectors of society have been crying out for clear guidance on exactly which stage means for them. So if the messaging here is not clear, if the plan is not clearly communicated, and if it's not easy for people to understand, I think you'll be facing into another iteration of communications problems for a government that has had more than its fair share of those and has shown propensity to generate those controversies and those problems for itself.
What do you think of that, Paul? How difficult is it it's not a simple matter for any state to bring out a whole new, I suppose, colour scheme, coded way of thinking about the way the country is going to be run over the next year. It takes a while for that to filter through, and there's plenty of scope both for deliberate misunderstanding and accidental misunderstandings along the way.
Yeah, I mean, different people want different things as well. Some people, I suppose, are looking for their hands to be held right through this crisis. And we probably have to move away from that emergency period that we had earlier in the year. There's talk of the new normal, whatever that means. And every government likes a plan, I suppose. But effectively, we do have to have some sort of functioning society and economy and health system. And that's the direction we're headed. Others want to get back to normal as soon as possible. I'm afraid the external evidence is just not very clear. You know, every time we think, for example, oh, yes, the schools have to open or something, or to take one example, when you dig into the emerging evidence, it's very mixed. And there are good signs, for example, to take the instance of schools. And there are negative signs, ones that say, for example, that children, especially older children, can carry the virus just as much as anyone else. And there may be transmission issues there. So there are no clear goalposts there, you know. So we're just going to have to make it up as we go along. But I think we differ from other countries. I get the sense that other European countries are just getting on with it. Some of them are doing some things really well, like testing a lot or opening up areas of society or whatever. Or maybe some of them are not doing things as well. But we make a lot of fuss about things here, I think, because we're a small country and the debate is always national rather than regional. So everybody gets into it. And there's a sense, of course, that nowadays that everyone's an expert too. So I think we need to dial down that debate a little bit and just find a way that allows for some level of normality to go on and economic activity to be restored and kids go back to school and so on.
And in practical terms, could I just ask you, Paul, I mean, you talked about perhaps the UK has to some extent got a little bit more control over its virus than it had previously. They've had regional or local lockdowns, but the UK is a much bigger country. So when they shut down whatever, you know, the Greater Manchester and East Yorkshire area, there's a population considerably larger than the whole of Ireland anyway. I know it's really difficult to figure this out, but would really small localised lockdowns in Ireland work? I mean, because a lot of people in, you know, Birr are saying they shouldn't be shut down at the moment because the core of the outbreak in Kildare is actually nearer to Dublin than it is to them.
Yeah, I mean, all the contradictions are being pointed out here. Many of the people working in some of these meat factories would be living in adjacent counties that are not affected by the lockdown, for example. So there are lots of complications. I think the 3-county lockdown that we're having at the moment is an experiment, and I think it's worth doing to see how that might work, because we can't go back to national lockdowns. It just will be bad for the psyche, apart from everything else. So I think there's an element of an experiment about it, and they may be able to refine it. So I think, you know, you've got to give the people the benefit of the doubt. It is true. I mean, other countries are struggling with this too, and it's hard to see whether there's an easy way out of it. But for the moment, I think we're, you know, I am encouraged by the fact that the case numbers have gone down very rapidly. So we may have more of a sharper spike than might have occurred otherwise. We do need to go back and see why it occurred and stop it happening again. But I think the graph is going down rapidly again. So there is reason for some encouragement. But of course, there's a lot to play for here, because it's going to have a huge impact on how and if schools open in the autumn.
Yeah, and let me ask you about schools, Jen, because this was supposed to be, I think, sort of the calm before the storm this month, to some extent, the end of the summer holidays. The Dáil isn't sitting. Give a chance for government departments to get up and ready for, you know, return to, if not normality, a new normality in schools. That's the big challenge now, isn't it? I mean, I know myself was out getting school books yesterday. There's so many people around the country will be, you know, wondering what it's going to be like for their kids when they go to school, if they do actually go to school on the Monday morning at the end of August or the beginning of September for the first time, and how long they'll be there and what happens if there's an outbreak and how all that's going to work. And I'm still extremely unclear on all of that.
It's the big challenge. And I think since Micheál Martin took over as Taoiseach, he made it very clear that his priority was always getting the schools open. And, you know, that's why there was this perceived trade-off maybe between pubs reopening and not reopening, is because the government's one stated aim since they took office was that schools would reopen. So that's been the overriding aim, that's been the overriding plan. And, you know, there's a couple of different elements to this. One is the safety, obviously, of having kids in the classroom, how you structure the classroom, whether they wear masks, what the protocols are, how long they're in there for, whether they go into a quarantine for 14 days, if they're in a classroom with another student who tests positive. So, you know, they were all the kind of logical and logistical things that needed to be worked out. And we know that the government has, I suppose put quite a bit of money behind it in terms of their 300 million euro plan. And the other element to it as well, of course, is the grades that Leaving Cert students will get. So it's going to be really, really challenging. There's going to be noses out of joint in that regard. I suppose even if you look at what was happening or what has happened in the last week in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon had to come out and apologise because a large number of students, I think around 120,000, had their results downgraded. And that was on the basis that the previous results of the school, so they were tied to the previous year. And I think around 15% of students who were from a disadvantaged background had their results downgraded in comparison to, I think, somewhere around 5 or 6% from those outside those areas. And then we saw she'd come out and apologise and talk about how the system was designed mainly for itself and rather for the individual, and that would be something that needs to be looked at. And actually, our system over here is quite similar to theirs in many ways, in that the results of students over here when they're getting their Leaving Cert results are actually tied to the previous year's academic performance. Now, the department has come out and said that they will seek to counteract that by looking at whether the groups of students in each individual class are this year or have been up until the point where they had to go home were trending academically better. And I suppose the danger there really is if you're looking at a group, are you allowing for an individual's performance? So we have a lot of similarities with Scotland in terms of how we are planning to assess Leaving Cert students. And I note with interest that the students' unions over the last few days have come out and said that they're effectively placing their trust, and students are placing their trust in the government to get this right. So they really need to get it right. Now we have an opportunity to look at what went wrong in Scotland and make sure it doesn't happen here. But there will always be people who feel that they didn't get the grade that they deserve. It'll be a matter of how many of those people, what areas are they from? Will it turn out that we are trending in areas where there are historic schools from historically disadvantaged areas that are getting lower grades? And has the class's group performance knocked out some individual performers, particularly if they were academically strong? So, you know, that all needs to be worked out. And I think we're somewhere around halfway between the process at the moment. And you would hope that the officials in the department are looking at this disaster over in Scotland and saying, well, we need to avoid this and here's how we can do it. So then I suppose there's that for the Leaving Cert students. And like you say, there's the logistical issues for first primary schools and all the concerns that parents have and all the conflicting evidence that we're hearing about children and how they transmit the virus.
Yeah, I wonder about all that, Jack. I mean, to a certain extent, as Jen says, Ireland has second mover advantage. They can see the mistakes that were made elsewhere and presumably adjust accordingly. Although I do wonder how much adjustment is possible. I mean, the announcement of the grades was already put back by about 3 or 4 weeks because of the complexity of the process. Presumably, they're right in the midst of that complexity. Do you start going in and fiddling with the algorithms or manually changing these things one at a time? I mean, that sounds like a recipe for legal cases later. And the other part of this is, I wonder, Norma Foley, first-time TD, first-time minister, running a department which didn't cover itself in glory necessarily in the earlier parts of the pandemic, now has these two huge things coming down the line at her, one the return to schools and the other one these exam results.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, do you start going in and rewriting the rule book, redrawing the algorithm right now? I think, as you correctly say, Hugh, you're making a rod for your own back in the future if you do, because imagine some student comes out with a C+ who anticipated an A, and they say, right, I want to do a personal data request on everything that was done in relation to the marking of my performance. And they see, well, I was on track for an A, and they came in and they fiddled with the algorithm, and I ended up with a D or a C. And that becomes enormously problematic. And I think that there has to be an acceptance, I suppose, in the Department of Education and also at cabinet level, that, you know, no matter what happens here, you're going to get really hard cases. When you do a profound systems change like this, people are going to be disappointed, and it is going to be shown to be fallible in some way, and it will have let some people down. So I think that they have to be anticipating, you know, that there will be court cases, that there will be difficult stories told through the media of kids who have effectively been denied a fair crack at the whip. And I think they have to kind of steel themselves for this in the same way that Paul was talking about building a kind of resilience into our society and into those systems about how we deal with the virus as it ebbs and flows. I think that the political system has to build a resilience into how it responds to these controversies which have their roots in the COVID-19 crisis, but all of a sudden erupt and emerge and become very febrile and very difficult to manage. Because if they don't build this resilience, if they do kind of lapse into a kind of reflexive inter-party backbiting, you know, and blame game, then the weak points of the government will emerge and will become more apparent. Weak points like the fact that they potentially put, you know, someone who is a first-term TD into an incredibly difficult portfolio. And those weak points won't survive for long under sustained pressure. So basically, they have to toughen up. They have to form resilience. Otherwise, I don't see the government lasting very long or administering very effectively.
Although it has been suggested to me, somewhat cynically perhaps, that the third level institutions, and that's the main reason why the Leaving Cert results are so important, is access to third level institutions, are quite happy maybe to open their doors a bit more this year because of the other financial pressures which they're facing and the absence of foreign students and a number of other elements there. So they just let them all in, if you like, to quite a lot of these courses, and then perhaps, you know, dump them all out when they fail their first year exams.
Well, look, I'm no education expert, but I would imagine that kind of that gets around one problem, which is the emptiness of lecture halls because we won't have foreign students, and you know that kind of slack in the system. If you have more domestic students circulating within the university system, it doesn't get around the rather larger and more pressing problem of financing the third level sector, because you know we all know that the fees that were charged from overseas students who weren't coming in through the Leaving Cert and free degree system were in some ways becoming, if not the lifeblood, certainly one of the very important IV lines going into the body of education at third level. And they need to figure out a way of replacing that. And I think, you know, fiddling around the edges in terms of access, perhaps generating a little bit more fee income from registration fees, I don't think that's going to cut it. And something more fundamental and something more thought out and well-rounded needs to be the solution there.
Paul, I want to ask you about testing and tracing because as part of the whole back-to-school process, that's going to be crucial in the event that there's, you know, there's outbreaks of one sort or another, that they're identified early and that the processes are put in place to shut down where required and to find contacts and to test those contacts and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, we had a big problem with capacity of testing at the outset of the pandemic. That seems to be a lot better now. Claims are that, in general, testing is much faster than it used to be. A couple of examples to the contrary over the last week or so that you've been writing about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's boring to have to go back to this about testing. I mean, but it is the nuts and bolts of responding in this situation, right? So as you remember, we did get up to 100,000 a week capacity after a problem period in the spring when we had to send off samples to Germany, embarrassingly. That 100,000 a week capacity has never been, I don't think it's ever been reached. And at the moment, more recent, at the end of July, we're running at a quarter capacity. Now, you might say that's because we don't have too many cases, but let's use the rest of the capacity to go and test people. For example, in Luxembourg, they're testing everyone. All families are getting invitations for asymptomatic testing, and it's going to be repeated in September to see what's out there and to deal with it. Sure, their figures are bad, and they knew their figures were bad and they had to do it. But why aren't we using the capacity that we have? Why haven't we looked into the alternatives to the to testing that are out there? I know there are a lot of problems with blood tests, antigen tests, about accuracy and things like that. But surely by now, some of them are providing some level of usefulness that we could employ. For example, if you have a rapid test, you could use that at points of entry to the country. If somebody tests positive, then you send them for the PCR test. If they test negative, then we watch them and see what happens. You know, so you can use different things. You can use pool testing, for example, whereby, let's say you pick a meat factory or a school and everybody pools their samples, or groups of people pool their samples. If the grouped sample is negative, that's good. That seems to indicate that neighborhood or that section of the factory is okay. If there is a positive sample, then you've got to go and test everybody. There are different ways of doing this to make your resources go as far as possible. But as you said in your question, there are anecdotal experiences. I'm hearing accounts of people having to wait 4 days for a test. I had to wait 4 days for a test in May, and that was too long then. It would be shocking that anybody would have to do that now at a time when we're only using quarter of our capacity. I'm very struck by the fact that two of the four meat plants felt the need to bring in a private lab to speed up the process of testing staff at their own expense. That speaks volumes, you know. So although the official statistics say, yes, we're giving a next day service and maybe the turnaround for tracing contacts is another day, on the face of it, that seems okay, unspectacular, but okay. But it seems yet again at odds with the sort of feedback that people are providing, both in specific areas and online and in anecdote.
And can I ask you, Paul, who would be driving that, both at the strategic level, which you talked about, at different types of testing, group testing, all those types of things, and at the operational level of making sure that the system is reacting fast enough?
Well, if you remember, the testing system was set up in an emergency and it was patched together in different ways. Now, in some places, it works well. If you're a hospital patient, if you're a healthcare worker who needs a test, the test is carried out in a hospital lab. It's quite near to where the patient is, for example. And the turnaround is reasonably quickly, and they're used to doing that. But for the rest of us in the community who require testing because we have symptoms, or maybe we don't even have symptoms, there are so many stages in the process. And I have to say, the first one is we have to alert someone first, and there is evidence that people are a bit slow to do that. But if you look at the testing figures, and you have this Monday, Tuesday phenomenon, for example, low figures, low positive figures on Monday, higher ones on Tuesday, what does that tell you? It tells you it's a 5-day system, not a 7-day system. How do GPs work? They work mostly 5 days. There are out of hour services, but we know there are problems with that. We're not getting a 7-day, 8-to-8 kind of service that we need. The system was set up in an emergency. It needs to be put on a more regular footing for the medium term with somebody in control and an effort to reduce the different steps in the sequence. So you would question, perhaps, is a GP referral always necessary? Could it be done online? Could we speed things up that way, for example, in certain circumstances? So, you know, there are ways to improve it, but it doesn't seem that level of continuous improvement doesn't seem to be happening in recent months, in my view.
Meanwhile, Jen, political life goes on. I'm going to ask Jack in a second about Leo Varadkar and his shoe wear options. But I mean, you're there. You're on what's usually, you know, the graveyard shift, which is the political beat in August. There's usually little or nothing going on. But I mean, with this kind of unusual this year, both because of the pandemic and dealing with the various consequences of that, and also because you had this brand new government and presumably ministers are reading into their briefs and figuring out what the hell is going to happen in September. So is there more politics than usual in the middle of August this year?
Yes. In a word, yes, there is a lot more politics than normal. Some of our listeners may be aware that this period is usually referred to as silly season for journalists. It's when you start reading in the papers about a new arrival at Dublin Zoo or, you know, some exotic animal abroad, and that's not really happening this year. And we all expected that because we knew to a certain extent that there would be a second wave of COVID, and we knew that COVID wasn't going to take a holiday just because it's August. So yeah, there is a lot more action this month than usual. In fact, from politicians that I've talked to, some of them are actually quite afraid to go on a break. Some of them are terrified to even admit that they're taking a week off because they're terrified that, you know, they'll be spotted on a beach while there are, you know, X deaths and an X number of cases, or maybe they're new ministers who feel that they should be, you know, reading into their brief at all hours of the day and night, which, to be fair, they probably should. So it is a completely different circumstance. And even the way that the government is operating throughout August, so we have some cabinet meetings, but we also will have every week a meeting of the cabinet committee on COVID. It met yesterday, it'll meet next week, it'll discuss that framework we talked about in relation to colour coding, it'll discuss communications, how to, you know, send out the message to the public about where we're at, because, you know, there's definitely a sense in government that people are exhausted and people are fed up and they just want this thing to go away, which is absolutely totally understandable, and I'm right there myself. It's kind of like almost business as normal, and just got to keep that coffee intake up and, you know, get on with it, to be honest.
I admire your fortitude. I also admire yours, Jack. I see that according to Twitter anyway, which as we know is the fount of all truth, you've been, you know, mainstream media shilling again for Leo Varadkar at his cheap photo ops out getting out buying a pair of shoes. What kind of shoes does Leo Varadkar wear these days, and why were you taking photographs of it?
Oh yeah, don't I feel silly for thinking the internet can take a joke? So there was a photo call and a press conference on Monday. Leo Varadkar was in a shoe shop, which is in receipt of the reopening Grand Plus. And while there, being Leo Varadkar, he decided to buy a pair of shoes. And he was sitting there, and I noted that there was an absence of the well-known novelty sock, and snapped a photograph, thinking, "Haha, this guy has a fairly dorky history with socks. The internet will get this joke." Tweeted it out, logged into my phone. Maybe half an hour later, I thought, that's rather a lot of notifications. a trend which perpetuated itself across the days that followed, as people articulated their views that this was perhaps somewhat short of the standard of journalism which they expected from both myself and the Irish Times. And you know, to which I can only say it was a tweet. It wasn't a news article.
I'm surprised it didn't end up on page one, actually. But anyway, you know.
Well, imagine my disappointment when I thought I had my page one pitch stowed away early in the day, only to find that, you know, this wasn't quite up to scratch. But I think there is, like, you know, mining this for something kind of relatively serious or interesting to talk about. I think there is something to this that when something like this kicks off, particularly when you have a front row seat to it, you do see the extent to which people are open to the argument online that, you know, their politicians are cosseted, interested only in photo opportunities, silly, removed, detached, and that the media is there only to kind of act as this kind of handmaiden to their photo opportunities. And you see just how fertile the ground is for that, and how quickly and how effectively those messages travel. And you remember, you know, just how far some people have been flung from the political center over the last few years, you know, and that effect, which kind of, I suppose, started in the financial crisis and accelerated through the austerity years, and now has to kind of come into contact with the political fragmentation that's going to occur during COVID. There's a lot of alienated people out there. There's a lot of angry people out there, and there's a political constituency for that. And you see it when something unexpected happens like that.
Paul, actually, a last question just in relation to that to you. I mean, Jen mentioned earlier on that these new colour-coded categories were not likely to see the blue category, which is basically the it's all over category for the foreseeable future at all. I mean, I've got a bleak theory, which is that grim though it was over the last 6 or 7 months, the weather was actually pretty good through spring, and then we had summer when it was bright and relatively warm. But if this continues in this manner, and with local lockdowns and other kinds of problems just continuing, and you get into November and December and January, that's where you could really start seeing both the psychological damage and also the economic hit, because people won't be able to hold out for much longer. That could be the worst part of this whole thing.
Yeah, nothing like finishing on a bum note, eh?
I always try.
Yeah, you have a point. I mean, in this pandemic, outdoors is good. That's definitely the case. Outdoors is good. And we had a good run of spring weather and so on. So confined spaces, indoor spaces is bad. Short days, dark days, even like the ones we've had in the last few days, are bad. I've been researching a feature this week on people with longer term complications. Often people who weren't seriously ill, some of them didn't even get a diagnosis. And the tunnel of despair that they're going through was very, very striking, actually. You know, a situation, a roller coaster of symptoms, you know, coming and going, you think you're better and then you fall back into it and so on. So that's, you know, and a lot of them were also mentioning the mental health aspect of that. But for the wider population, yes. I mean, the government does understand the importance of returning to schools. In my own household, you know, the message came in yesterday, no after schools activity for the entire academic year in primary school. You know, those kind of messages are going to come in. The limitations of each individual school's their provision is going to come in over the next few weeks. And I think that's going to be, you know, really cautionary for people. Yes, we need a medium to longer term plan, really, for this. Yes, we need to try and establish zones of normality or activity where we can. And then we need to chase the virus and feel that we're on top of this. I think that's the thing. Because I think when you rest back, then you feel that you're being pursued by the virus, and you feel the lack of agency, and that you feel helpless. So I think empowerment, both nationally on, you know, government and individually, is the way forward, really.
On that sobering but realistic note, we'll leave it there. Thanks to Paul, to Jack and to Jennifer, and to our producer Declan Conlon and JJ Vernon, our engineer. Before we go, allow me yet again to encourage you to, if you have not already done so, go to irishtimes.com/subscribe, where you can sign up for unlimited access to the Irish Times for the introductory price of just €1. And if you want to get in touch, we would be delighted to hear from you. Just mail us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.